think of a British prison, what names come to mind? Barlinnie, Wormwood Scrubs, perhaps even Strangeways. But if I said a woman's prison, chances are we'd all think of exactly the same one. Holloway.
The guards treated everyone in the same way, so there was someone coming in just behind me who clearly they had seen before because they were welcoming her back.
She was kept in the basement for some reason because she was on a 24-hour watch. And she set fire to herself.
The woman was held down in her cell and a tube was put up her nose or down her throat, and that itself was very distressing.
The iconic prison has housed some of Britain's most notorious female murderers, from Ruth Ellis and Myra Hindley to Rose West, and more recently, Joanne Dennehy. Now in the fast-changing prison landscape, Holloway has closed. The era of the Victorian-built institution is slowly coming to an end. Society is now looking to rehabilitate and reform, as well as to punish.
As a criminologist and as a former prison governor, I know that what happens inside our prison's walls not only tells us something about the kinds of people we lock up, but also something about ourselves, our politics, and our culture.
For over a century and a half, Holloway absorbed penal fashions, change, and transformation. When it first opened in 1852, for example, it accommodated both genders. But from 1902 onwards, it housed only female prisoners. During its reign as one of Europe's biggest women's prisons, Holloway carried out the highest number of female executions throughout the 20th century in England and Wales. Five women met the hangman's noose. It's had its fair share of controversy, from audacious escapes, to bullying, to sex scandals with guards, to the abolition of the death penalty. Have the type of offenders we incarcerate today changed? And have prison reforms made a difference in rehabilitation? Liz, why does Holloway have such a fearsome reputation?
Well, I think Holloway's got such a fearsome reputation because of some of the notorious female criminals who've been through the doors of Holloway. So we're thinking about people like Vanessa George, the paedophile. We're talking about the spree killer, Joanne Dennehy. So these women who've committed quite significant violent crimes.
Holloway has been witness to some of the most important and significant moments in criminal history. From the rise of stranger danger, provoked by the Moors murderer Myra Hindley, to housing the last woman to be hanged, Ruth Ellis. These murderous women hit the headlines at the time and have remained in our consciousness. But in reality, women only constitute 5% of the prison population.
Well, I think we've got such a fascination with women who commit violent crime, particularly crime like murder, because they are so abhorrent. They're the absolute antithesis of femininity. And we become fixated on these extreme cases, and we forget that actually they're the minority of women who offend.
Today, there are about 90,000 prisoners in England and Wales, but only 4,000 of them are women. More than half of women are imprisoned for committing offences in order to get money to buy drugs, and 82% have committed non-violent acts.
You're professional, you're educated, you're middle class. That wouldn't be the kind of woman that you were encountering in Holloway, was it?
Oh, there were some. There's no doubt about that. There were some women who had come in because something had happened in their work in the city. So I wasn't unique. But of course, I was different from the vast majority of the girls there. Almost everyone had been on drugs before. It's a very unstable environment, and I did describe Holloway as a bit of a madhouse, which somehow rather sort of functioned.
The story of Holloway raises many questions about human nature and how we deal with its darker side. Scan history's most shocking murders, and you'll find the Victorians behind the most grisly of deeds. During the late 1800s and early 1900s, infanticide accounted for around 65% of all homicides in England. One such serial killer was Amelia Dyer, dubbed the Angel Maker, who was responsible for the murders of around 400 babies over a 20-year period.
Child murder was much more common in the Victorian period, simply because this was a period in which there were many more unwanted pregnancies because there wasn't the amount of contraception, adoption was nearly impossible, and of course, abortion was a terrible backstreet event that pretty much killed the mother. Women did often try and kill their children. There were babies thrown into the Thames, there were babies strangled, and men got off scot-free, but women were condemned.
One pair of women who took advantage of the situation were the notorious Annie Walters and Amelia Sack, who became known as the Finchley Baby Farmers.
Annie Walters and Amelia Sack were two London women who were involved in the very popular industry of baby farming. This was legal, many women were involved in it, it was just these two turned it to murder. So baby farming essentially was when young women who got pregnant, servants, working class girls, they got pregnant outside of wedlock, couldn't afford to look after the babies. They'd have the baby, they'd give them to the women, they'd pay the women a large amount of money, £25 to £30, huge amount of money, to have the child adopted or boarded.
Last year I became pregnant and saw an advertisement in the newspaper. I went and saw Amelia Sack. The terms agreed upon were £1.01 a week, or £3.03 a week during confinement. After I'd been there a short time, Sack asked if I'd like to have the child adopted. I said I should, and asked her how much it would cost. She said £25 or £30. On Saturday, November 15th, my child was born. I only saw it for a moment before it was washed. On Sunday morning, Dr. Wiley came and saw me. The baby was not there. He asked where it was. Sack said my sister had it. I did not say anything.
Sack was in charge. She said he took these babies, killed them, and no one seemed any the wiser. And it wasn't until Annie Walters' landlord, a policeman, became rather suspicious of babies that seemed to come and not be here anymore. And he got rather suspicious of that, chased things up, and then they found baby clothes at Amelia Sack's house. We have no idea how many children exactly they killed. We simply don't know, but it's very clear that they probably killed them in the dozens. And because the mothers were at the bottom of Victorian society, they thought they'd never be caught.
On the 16th of January 1903, it took an Old Bailey jury just 40 minutes to find them both guilty. And they were executed a few weeks later on the 3rd of February in Holloway. It was the first female double hanging of the 20th century, and the last.
Did it cause any kind of scandal or moral panic? Was there a great deal of discussion about baby farming?
There was a huge moral panic about the women who were doing the baby farming and about these young mothers who were creating these illegitimate children. There was really no recognition of the fact that these maidservants, dirt poor maidservants, had very little choice but to use the baby farms.
Many murderous individuals found themselves at the mercy of Victorian-style justice following their heinous crimes. But it wasn't just the killers that were locked up. Pickpockets and thieves also faced harsh punishment. 50 years earlier, the most common Victorian retribution for crime was transportation, sending the offenders first to America, then to Australia and Tasmania. Another solution was execution, with hundreds of offences carrying the death penalty.
What did the Victorians want prisons to deliver, to do?
Prisons were very much about punishment, and offenders were to be kind of held up as examples of how not to behave. So very often Victorian prisons were incredibly grand buildings in the middle of towns or cities, so everybody could see them and knew what they were. But more importantly, they knew who was housed in those institutions, so people who've broken the law.
The rise in petty offending and a surge in the prison population forced building on a massive scale. The Victorians built or modified over 80 prisons throughout England and Wales. The new City of London prison was a fortified castle known as Holloway. And over the next 150 years, its name would become infamous. But it wasn't just murderers such as Ruth Ellis and Myra Hindley that would line Holloway's Hall of Fame. One woman would die for love, much to the horror of the nation.
Holloway was seen as a solution to London's growing prison population. It was originally known as Camden Castle, and its enormous gate lodge was modelled on Warwick Castle.
and inside were equally imposing Victorian Gothic buildings that could house up to 436 inmates.
The prison had 4 3-story radial wings on a star plan, with an administration wing and detached female and juvenile wings. The male wings had workshops at their outer ends. The female wing had washhouses, and the juvenile wing, schoolrooms.
The Victorians were very keen on seeing everybody in prison. The officers could stand in the middle of the star, and they could turn around and they could look down long corridors, and they could see who was out of their cell, they could see who was going into someone else's cell. That system of surveillance was favoured and is present in many prisons.
Prisons for the Victorians were all about punishment. Rehabilitation didn't really come into it at all, so life was incredibly harsh in prisons. There certainly was very little in the way of skills, of training, of anything like that to prepare people for the outside world again.
Once inside, the prisoners were made to pay for their crimes. They were kept in silence and made to do intense menial work. Walking a treadwheel or pulling a rope apart for oakum were the most common forms of hard labour.
So the silent and the separate system was based on those two concepts of separation of prisoners from other people and of quietness, of silence during their sentences. And those are very, very harsh conditions, aren't they? When you think about people as social beings, they talk to one another. Well, the Victorian prisoners weren't allowed to do that.
What was silence going to deliver?
Well, it was thought that through being silent, they'd be more repentant because they weren't conversing with other people. So the only thing that they had to kind of think about was themselves and what they'd done.
In Victorian England, many more women were sentenced to prison. Women constituted about 17% of the prison population, as opposed to approximately 5% today. 90% of Victorian female prisoners were given short sentences. Some inmates thought prison conditions were relatively pleasant and saw it as an improvement on life in a workhouse.
I can have a room to myself, and what with 3 meals a day and the doctor whenever I want him, I'm better off here.
During the late 1880s, turnover was high and the average daily prison population was over 2,500 for women and nearly 12,000 for men. Holloway became so heavily populated that the prison was forced to add more cells, bringing the number of inmates up to nearly 1,000.
Increasingly, as the Victorian age wore on, people started to say, we need to separate men and women. This is immoral. And after all, a lot of the women who were imprisoned were prostitutes, and they might even try and earn more money or turn more tricks inside the prison. There was a new impetus towards separating men and women, partly because of Victorian morality, but also partly of some notion of protecting the women themselves.
I think during this period, it was a really harsh time. There was an awful lot of poverty, and many women were kind of finding themselves having to rely on sex work, on prostitution to make ends meet. And prostitution was something that was inherently criminalised by the Victorians, so there were lots of offences relating to prostitution, and women found themselves, at the wrong end of the law.
The closure of London's oldest prison, Newgate, coincided with a moral panic about sex workers, which in turn created demand for more prison spaces for women.
At the beginning of the 20th century, men had been removed from Holloway and only women remained within those walls. And pretty soon the prison became synonymous with some of the country's most notorious and dangerous female offenders.
How did Victorian society view women who committed crime?
They were seen as, number one, transgressing the code by which the poor should live. The poor should accept their situation. They should be grateful to the rich. They shouldn't steal. The poor should be honest. And they also transgressed the notion of woman. And the notion of woman was one who was meek, who was obedient, who'd rather die in penury and poverty than sell her body or steal.
What you did on the outside was also reflected in how you were treated inside the prison's walls. The class system was a fundamental part of British life, and Holloway was no exception.
Kate, what would be the difference between a middle-class woman going into jail and a working-class woman going into jail?
Well, there were really three classes in jail. There were the first class, and these were the very wealthy prisoners. They were allowed to read, they were allowed to have books, they were allowed to receive visits. There were the middle-class grouping, the middle-class women. This was quite a small grouping, but they did sewing. And then there were the bottom grouping. They were the great unwashed. They survived on porridge. They had very little privileges whatsoever. They were mistreated, no one cared about them, and they lived in squalor.
Political prisoners were usually seen as first class, but when the suffragettes entered the fray as the Women's Social and Political Union in 1903, they were downgraded to middle or even lower class.
Well, the suffragettes were a group of women in this country who were passionate about securing the right to vote for women.
They would do anything from setting fire to post boxes, to breaking windows, to even slashing paintings in the National Gallery. So they were seen as violent and they were seen as problematic, and they were the ones that were thrown into prison.
Holloway was essentially a meeting ground for the most famous and popular suffragettes. Spending time inside the prison became known as the Holloway degree, which earned them the right to wear the Holloway badge, an arrow of purple, white and green mounted on a silver portcullis.
The problem was that once they got into Holloway, they wouldn't be cowed by the system. They did all kinds of things. They sang suffragette songs. There's a great story of how the suffragettes would march round the exercise yard and Ethel Smythe would be conducting them with her toothbrush from the window in the suffragette songs.
The suffragettes fought the government from inside the prison by taking part in hunger strikes. It became their greatest weapon for their cause.
The government was so afraid of a woman dying in prison and becoming this martyr to the cause that women had to be force-fed. And that itself was very distressing. The woman was held down in her cell and a tube was put up her nose or down her throat. And there were even records of women in other prisons being fed up other orifices, such as the vagina or the anus.
How does the government react to the fact that a number of suffragettes want to go on hunger strike?
Well, in comes the Cat and Mouse Act, and this is essentially a piece of legislation which enables the prison to basically let these prisoners starve themselves, not force feed them. So they become weaker, they become less disruptive, you know, some of them die when they're released from prison, and because they're physically so unwell, they're unable to engage in the kind of activities that they were engaging in before.
The suffragettes would be released on licence to regain their strength. If they committed an offence whilst out on licence, they would be immediately rearrested and returned to prison, starting the whole process again. This, from the government's point of view, was a very simple but effective weapon against the suffragettes. Their war against political injustice ended when Britain was plunged into World War I in 1914. Their campaign moved from one of violence to one of support for the government. The vital work undertaken by women during the war led to the Representation of the People Act in 1918, allowing women to vote.
British sensibilities about women and their place in society framed the next execution that took place at Holloway. Despite winning the vote and women seemingly having more equality, they were also still expected to be perfect wives, mothers, and homemakers, or face moral condemnation.
Edith Thompson was the perfect 20s woman. She was intelligent, she was successful, she was attractive, and she was married to a loving husband. And then she fell in love with a young man, Freddie Bywater, quite a lot younger than her. And they had this very tormented affair. She fell completely in love with him. And then when she and her husband were coming back after a night out, Freddie Bywater basically jumped out from behind the bushes and killed her husband. Even though Freddie did it, Edith was tried for the murder as well. And what incriminated her were all these letters in which she wrote to Freddie saying how unhappy she was, how she wished her husband would die, and it became this huge poor celebre.
He was telling his mother of our Sunday morning escapades, and he put great stress on the fact of the tea tasting bitter, as if something had been put in it, he said. Now I think whatever else I try at him will still taste bitter. He will recognise it and be more suspicious. I thought a lot about what you said of Dan, darling. Don't trust him. I don't mean don't tell him anything, because I know you never would. If we were successful in our actions, darling, circumstances may afterwards make us want friends or helpers. And we must have no enemies.
One thing that moved people was the fact that Edith was a woman, and the last woman they'd hanged was in 1907. And this was the post-war, this was the 20s, and everyone thought, we are different now after the war. It's a new world, and we are not like those barbaric pre-war types.
One of the things that applies regularly to women who offend, whether we're talking about the extreme end of offending or the run-of-the-mill type of female offending, is that the woman is often described as being doubly deviant. What is doubly deviant?
When we talk about women being doubly deviant, essentially we're saying they've committed a crime, so they've broken the rules, the laws of society, but also they've crossed a moral boundary as well in terms of what we expect from women's behaviour.
I can't avoid thinking that a sinister logic operated against Edith Thompson. Her husband was dead, her lover would die, and this woman needed to atone for the loss of the two men. Edith Thompson and Freddie Bywaters were hanged on the 9th of January 1923, Edith at Holloway and Freddie at Pentonville.
Edith was particularly traumatising for the executioner because she had a huge hemorrhage when she was hanged, and there was some talk that possibly she was pregnant, and it was very upsetting for the executioner, who later killed himself. And after that, there was the innovation brought in that women had to wear very thick calico canvas knickers so that no other hemorrhage would ever be seen by anyone. So it was fair enough if it happened, but we could never possibly see the consequences of our brutality.
Edith became the first woman in 20 years to be hanged in Britain, and the third at Holloway. By the early 1930s, there were fewer convictions and the numbers of inmates decreased rapidly. The daily female prison population had declined by 400% since the 1900s and stood at around 600. Women's prisons also dropped in numbers, from 62 to just 7. Holloway became Britain's largest and London's only female prison. It would also become the site for one of the most hotly debated topics, the death penalty. And one woman's execution would change the tide of public opinion. The era of the Victorian prison was coming to an end. With their huge, imposing buildings and hard punishment, a thing of the past.
During Victorian and Edwardian times, Holloway earned itself a fearsome reputation as a formidable house of corrections. Then prison fashions changed. Prison wasn't just to be about hard labour. Preventing crime through rehabilitation became the objective of the day.
During the Second World War, women's roles in society started to change. And in 1945, Holloway appointed its first female governor, Charity Taylor.
She was very interested in the idea of basically preparing women for life on the outside during their time at Holloway. And some of the reforms that she enacted really were unprecedented.
She suggests that you need the psychological approach to prisoners. So what she's saying is, these aren't evil, bad people who are simply evil and are utterly horrible people, that they might have had unlucky lives, difficult lives, and they might have mental difficulties. And we should try and approach them in this psychological way and see if we can help them.
Women were allowed to wear makeup. They were allowed to wear their own clothes. And they were allowed to keep their babies in prison for those women who gave birth to children whilst they were incarcerated. So she really did make quite a lot of difference to the lives of a lot of women who were under her care.
But there was one change Charity Taylor couldn't influence, and that was the death penalty. There had been no executions for 31 years at Holloway since the hanging of Edith Thompson. In 1954, Stilo Christofi became the fourth woman to be executed.
Stilo Christofi was a Greek Cypriot woman who came over to London to live with her son. Her son had been rather successful. He'd been a waiter. He was married to a fashion model, had three children. And unfortunately, Stilo Christofi, she hated her daughter-in-law. So when her son went away, she pretty much killed her daughter-in-law in the kitchen. She strangled her and then she set the place on fire. And then she realised to her panic that there were children upstairs sleeping. She couldn't really speak English. So she dashed out into the street, finally found some people and said to them, children, children, children asleep and the house on fire. When the authorities came, they found the body of the daughter-in-law. It was clear she'd been strangled. And that was very clear that she had actually tried to kill her daughter-in-law.
Stilo Christoffi's execution stirred little interest amongst the public.
The reason why Stilo Christoffi simply didn't get the sympathy that other women did who were hanged was that she was seen as an immigrant, she couldn't really speak English, she wasn't a very sympathetic figure. Also, it was very hard for the public to see Christoffi's crime in the sympathetic way that they did for Ruth Ellis.
Ruth Ellis was Holloway's fifth and final execution. Her case evoked huge public interest and caused the role of capital punishment to be questioned.
Ruth Ellis was a young woman, she worked in a nightclub, she was glamorous, she'd been a model, and she had this very tormented relationship with a man called David Blakely.
It accelerated very quickly, they moved in together very fast, and it was a very kind of turbulent relationship. And they both started seeing other people quite soon after they'd moved in together. And this made David incredibly sort of jealous and incredibly controlling. And the relationship was just generally a bit of a disaster. Ruth miscarried after David had punched her in the stomach. So this really was an incredibly unpleasant relationship. And then not long after that, Ruth waits for him outside a pub in London where he's there drinking with friends. And when he leaves the pub, she shoots him. And he dies of his injuries.
Ruth Ellis became the last woman to be executed in Britain. On Wednesday, the 13th of July, 1955, she was hanged by Albert Pierpoint at Holloway.
I think Ruth Ellis's execution was the moment where, you know, capital punishment was going to come to an end. Such was the emotion. And on the day of her execution, there were people queued outside the prison on the pavements. There were women there with prams. So everybody had an interest in the case and really didn't want this to happen to anybody else.
It took another 10 years after the execution of Ruth Ellis for the abolition of the death penalty in Great Britain to become law. Hanging was replaced with a mandatory sentence of life imprisonment.
The death penalty had gone, the execution shed disappeared, and there was no longer any need for the condemned cells. Holloway was about to enter a period of penal reform.
The old prison was like a Victorian nightmare. It was like hell, really. You walked into it. It was grey, smelly, dirty. There were huge, great floors separated only by suicide wires. And people used to throw things on it, toilet paper and things, and it used to dribble down. It was dark, gloomy, and the inspectorate always used to criticise it for its standard of hygiene, and it was not a very nice place to work at all. It was horrible.
My first night in Holloway Prison was hell. I was in a cell with a crazy woman who picked off her toenails and put them into my tea mug. The wind screamed through the window. The glass had been smashed out from riots, and the gaps were stuffed with loo roll and books from the library. There was a bucket to pee in, and at 5 a.m. I was told to slop out, where the contents of the bucket was thrown out. I had a glob of porridge in the morning, which I had to eat with toenails lady in my cell.
Thinking in terms of art and colour and painting, the Victorian, the old Victorian buildings, what kind of colours were they?
I could say grey. That can be pleasant, but actually kind of the colour was sludge. I can't think of it in any other way. I know that's not a colour, but it actually was sludge.
It sounds like education had a very low priority in the old Holloway. Would that be an accurate way of describing it?
Prisons are not there for education purposes. The women had visits to go to, they had to see their lawyers, they had medicals, a lot of the women were ill. And after they were all free from that, then they had time to come to education.
In 1968, it was decided that Holloway should be rebuilt as a local prison and psychiatric institution. There was a school of thought that women could be cured of their criminality and that the root cause was psychological. Building work was undertaken whilst the prison remained operational.
In the old prison, there was an awful lot of self-harm and attempted suicides, and there were a lot of fights, and there were a lot of barricading in. And it was very, very tense. And there was no way to dissipate that strength because there was no real meaningful activities. Violence, therefore, was often against the women themselves. I remember one young woman, she was only 18. She was kept in the basement for some reason because she was on a 24-hour watch. And she set fire to herself, and goodness knows what kind of state of mind she must have been in.
The psychological toll of being in prison affects inmates in different and sometimes extreme ways. One prisoner who seemed to adapt to life in prison was known as the most hated woman in Britain, Myra Hindley. In 1966, Ian Brady and Myra Hindley were sentenced to life for the murders of five children in Greater Manchester. Although Hindley had a notorious reputation, she was surprisingly well-behaved and even turned to the Catholic faith. She got on well with her fellow inmates and, in particular, with one of the guards.
Myra Hindley spent several years at Holloway, and she became incredibly close to one of the female prison officers there. She had an affair with a lady called Pat Cairns for 3 years. Pat was helping her formulate a plan to escape. One of the other prisoners flagged this up to the governor and said, look, I think Myra Hindley is trying to plan an escape. And Myra Hindley was actually able to use her kind of charm and her manipulation to convince the governor that this other prisoner was lying.
The plan continued until 1973, when police heard rumours of an escapee using duplicate keys. Myra and Pat Cairns had been planning to travel to South America.
Pat really did pay quite a high price for this because she went to prison herself for a number of years and lost her career in the prison service. So I think it's proof that even when violent female criminals are behind bars, they're still quite able to manipulate others. Had the Hindley and Brady case happened soon after Ruth Ellis's execution, I think it would have been quite instrumental in turning the tide of public opinion. Because on the one hand, you have Ruth Ellis, she's somebody who's a victim herself. Then on the other hand, you've got Hindley and Brady, whose cold and calculated killing of children really did, you know, make people feel, you know, sick to their stomachs.
Myra Hindley served over 10 years in Holloway before moving prison. She was never released and died of bronchial pneumonia in 2002. It had taken 15 years to redevelop the new Holloway, and when it was completed in 1985, the archaic buildings and harsh conditions that had existed for over 100 years had gone. But would the new buildings and new reforms result in any real change and bring the reputation of Holloway out of the Dark Ages?
The Gothic buildings of Victorian Holloway had literally housed thousands of women over its 120 years. However, rehabilitation demanded a different kind of architecture, and the new buildings of Holloway were supposed to reflect that objective.
The new prison was a purpose-built prison, and it was built virtually like a student's accommodation, it seemed to me. The whole place was much lighter. There was a huge purpose-built gym. There were loads and loads of facilities. There was a purpose-built education block, which was wonderful. We had our own classrooms. We had our own library. So the whole thing became much more civilised and humane.
The layout of New Holloway had changed from one that had good sight lines to that of a hospital with long corridors and hidden corners, making surveillance much harder.
The women in Holloway probably had more officers to talk to than their equivalent men, say, in any other London prison built on different architectural lines. They're probably going to feel better about being in prison than they would otherwise feel, because actually people feel psychologically contained, not only by healthcare staff, but also by a real relationship with officers, who, of course, are also there to help them.
Did you have a view about those conversations being between women and women, or did male officers working in Holloway add a dimension that was helpful as well?
I think they did. I have met and still know many really good male prison officers. And I think they do bring something different, because it was one of the things that many women in prison haven't had is okay men around, actually. They've had exploitative men, abusive men. So if they come across officers who embody okay men, that can just change their perspective on things a bit in a helpful way.
The new Holloway seemed to want to address and deal with the reasons behind the crimes committed by its inmates. In 2015, 53% of women in prison reported having suffered emotional, physical, or sexual abuse as a child, and 66% had committed offences to get money to buy drugs.
Women who come into Holloway have had very poor educational experiences. If you are then presented with an educational timetable and are very wary of it, and you come in with that lack of education, there's one class that you don't feel intimidated with, and that's the art class, because you kind of have some idea of what's going to be expected of you. Not only that, but for the women who couldn't speak English, it was the one class that they could be with other inmates on an equal footing.
And art can often release a great many different emotions and create very different reactions to the kinds of things that are on canvas. What sort of things did the women paint when you were there?
The women who were down on the medical unit, who had mental health problems, often could paint wonderful, wonderful imaginings, images from their head in a very spontaneous, unselfconscious way, which sometimes I quite envied, because I'm bogged down by all that formal training, which they didn't have. And their colours were absolutely just so unselfconsciously kind of dangerous in a way.
Not all residents of Holloway were incarcerated for violent crime. Most were there for minor offences, with 80% serving less than 6 months. Economist Vicky Price found herself on the wrong side of the law for perverting the course of justice after accepting speeding points on behalf of her then-husband, former politician Chris Hune.
What were your expectations about going into Holloway?
I had no expectations. I didn't really know anyone had gone to prison before. So if I say that actually my expectations were probably wrong, in the sense that it was better than I would have imagined, in the sense of the way I was treated. The guards treated everyone in the same way, so there was someone coming in just behind me who clearly they had seen before, because they were welcoming her back.
How was a typical day structured at Holloway?
So at night you get locked up normally in the weekday from 7 in the evening until 8 in the morning, or perhaps later. And then you can go out and make yourself some breakfast. And unless you have somewhere to go to, such as an activity you've already signed up to, whether it's education or sport, then you get locked up again until lunchtime. And then you have an hour again and locked up. And then later you have possibly a couple of hours of mixing with others until they lock you up again for the night.
Do you think the hardest thing you would have had to adapt to was being locked up?
Yes, I think for me it was important. And also going out into the open, you only have half an hour of possibly walking around, and when it rains, the guards don't really want you to be out there because they have to be there supervising you. But it was seriously important for me to be out there and breathe the air. I went out for the first day, and the women all came to me and said, "Oh, we didn't think you'd want to mix with us and that you wouldn't come out and join us." And I said, "You must be joking. Of course I'd want to come out." And they sort of sat me on a bench, but it's actually what I wanted to do was walk around and around, get a bit of exercise, and started telling me their stories.
There were 5 beds in my cell. It was unsettling having different people in and out every week. Most of them were drug addicts. It was meant to be a pregnancy wing, but they let anyone in there. Of course I was upset when they took her. I was devastated. I'd already had 2 children taken away from me, so when I found out I was pregnant again, I made changes. I'd been a drug addict for 13 years, moving from place to place, in and out of prison. I grew up in care, so never had a home of my own. So I got myself a flat and on the methadone program. But when a warrant was delivered, I knew I'd go down.
And when you started listening to their stories, what was it that really stuck out for you?
Well, the first thing is how vulnerable a number of the women were, and the issues with whoever they had been with and the things they were doing for others, which got them caught, if you like. And the other thing is that what they had done in many cases was quite trivial, and yet the separation from their children and their families was devastating. And we know that actually depresses women hugely. What we see is that even though women, certainly in England and Wales, make up only 5% of the population in prison, they account for a third of all the attempts to harm themselves.
What sort of mental health problems were women at Holloway presenting?
They have a range of problems, if you like, sort of minor mental health problems and also some major ones. So what are minor mental health problems? Well, kind of reactive states of mind, so that adjustment to imprisonment, states of anxiety, states of depression. They also have quite significant personality difficulties. And then a small proportion of them will have the kinds of major mental illnesses that people might know about, so schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, so lifelong conditions that are significantly disabling and where many would argue that women with those conditions should not, in fact, be in prison.
In 2015, HMP Holloway was deemed inadequate, antiquated, and ordered to close. 6 months later, offenders were moved to newer prisons, which were described as having more humane surroundings. In England and Wales, there are now 11 women's prisons housing nearly 4,000 inmates.
When we look at female offenders who've committed violent offences, then we should be putting them in prison. We should be separating them so they're not a danger to the public. But I think when we do that, we should be looking at addressing their behaviour, at looking at where it comes from. And, you know, eventually these women will have the chance to be reintegrated into society to one day be released. So we need to make sure that we get that right. And I think smaller prisons are much better than larger prisons.
We still have this notion of an underclass, people who are poor, illiterate, abused, suffering from mental illness, and there is no help for them in the wider state. And you look at the Victorian system in which the poor, the illiterate, the abused, and the people suffering from mental illness, they were the ones who were imprisoned. And then you think, how far have we come today? These are once more the people we're filling our prisons with. And you begin to say to yourselves, we often think we're so superior to the Victorians. We think we're so much better. We think that they are a class-ridden, sexist, and hypocritical society. But have we really changed that much?
The capital's only female prison, as the country's largest prison for women, sometimes housing our most notorious female offenders, Holloway was always going to have a place in the British psyche, even if that place was sometimes confused by our attitudes towards women, women who offend, and the problems that they pose. And what of the future? There will always be a small number of women who need to be locked up because they're dangerous. But do we still have to continue to look backwards to the past to find inspiration about what to do with the vast majority of women who offend? Penal fashions come and penal fashions go.